To mute or unmute yourself, press star 6. There are
0
other callers present. You will hear music until the second party arrives.
Ellie.
Welcome to the conference call, Ellie.
Well, it's hard to hear you.
It is.
Now I can hear you. Is anyone else here?
No. I was far away from the computer before. That's probably why it was hard to hear.
Oh, well, now I can hear you.
Oh, that's good. Well, God, I got nothing done yesterday at all. I worked like 4.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing about the sprint is that now an 8-hour day is easy.
It was for me last week, and then yesterday I just, it might be that I didn't get much sleep, and it might be, I don't know what it was. Yeah, last week it was like I was doing it without even thinking. I also had to do a bunch of stuff to get pretty for vacation yesterday, so I'm almost done. These things take a lot of planning. They really do.
Yeah. I'm really excited about this family and friends thing I figured out with Verizon. You know, because I don't know how many times you can switch the numbers that don't charge you minutes, but... like, I don't have that many on my list right now, so...
Hello, this is Nathan Fiala.
Hi there.
Hi, Nathan. Hi. Oh, this is Ellie.
Okay. You know, I'm very sorry. I have to announce that I can't actually stay for the conference call. I did just RSVP, but I actually have been called away on a meeting.
Okay.
So I just wanted to call real quick and let you know that I can't join. I'm very sorry.
Okay, it's too bad. Thanks for letting us know, and I guess we'll set up for another time.
Okay, please, yeah. Keep me in the loop with anything. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, so far... Alright, I worked 5.4 yesterday. I mean, there was a huge block of time that I just was looking for a hotel and shit. Plus, I didn't sleep.
I mean, that's not a total disaster.
Yeah. Because there was like a 4-hour block of time, plus the fact that I went to bed at 5.
Alana, coming in.
Hello.
Hi, Alana. How are you?
Hi. I'm good.
This is Ellie.
This is Holden.
And, Holden. Yeah, he's...
Nice.
And Nathan just called in and said that he was called away to another meeting, and so he's not able to make it to this call. So I think it's just going to be the three of us.
Okay.
So thanks for your interest and you know, being interested in talking with us and offering your thoughts. We were hoping to, just briefly. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at what we've written up on the Carter Center, but we're interested in hearing your thoughts about that. And I can certainly quickly run through, both the strengths and weaknesses we saw. Then we want to hear your feedback. And then we also just wanted to tell you what our plan is from here and see what you think about it and if you have any thoughts. And that's basically our plan for the call.
Okay, I did read what you wrote about the Carter Center, but honestly, it wasn't today. So if you didn't mind walking me back through a little bit, I'd be grateful.
Sure.
No, but maybe, could we start, like, really, I mean, I would actually kind of, now that I think about it, like, to start as open-ended as we can, just, I mean, you know, are there any thoughts that jump to mind when you read through our stuff, you know, either on specifics, conclusions, or on our approach in general? I would like to start with that, and then we can get more into specifically, okay, this is what we think. What do you think?
Okay. In general, I like the way that you've shifted from talking about international charity to talking about the developing world and ways to change lives and effective interventions rather than using the term charity, which I think is a little more loaded. And that was sort of bothering me at first, and I was really glad to see you drop that language.
Okay.
Especially because so much of the work that's done in the developing world isn't funded by individuals or philanthropists. It's funded by governments that have strategic interests, that it's really not charity.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
I guess I'm a little unclear on that feedback. Like, I guess, I mean, we don't use the term charity when it doesn't apply, but in my mind, we haven't dropped the term. I'm open to dropping it, but I generally would use it when I'm talking to a potential donor. I mean, that's what GiveWell exists for. We exist
right.
for donors. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that we read, a lot of the literature we discuss is not about charity, and so when it's not, I call it something else. But, you know, I don't know. Like, unless you have an argument, you know, specifically about this, I was planning on continuing to use that term when I think it applies, which is often, because that's what we do.
Right, no, that I totally agree with. I mean, you're trying to give donors a way of giving their charity in a way that's effective. I certainly agree that's what the people that you're working with are doing. I just meant in the broadest sense, the field of supporting development and improving people's lives globally is not exclusively the province of charity.
Right.
There's a lot of different interests engaged on that, and calling the whole field international charity is the thing that I'm leery about.
I see. Okay, I agree with you on that.
Okay. I mean, I think we do. Yeah, it seems like that you're using the vocabulary the same way. So.
All right. Other thoughts, or should we go into more specifics?
The only other thought was looking at the research agenda. Sorry, I'm coming across as very critical, and I don't mean to be.
Oh, no problem at all. I mean, that's the purpose.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about your underlying thinking. It feels somehow a little haphazard.
Okay.
Okay. Could you explain a little more?
Sure. Let's see. I've got it open on my computer so that I can... Crossing. No, I guess haphazard's the wrong word. I'm trying to find a way to articulate this that's useful for you. Don't mean this dead silent, but I've actually been thinking about useful things to say to you.
No problem.
I guess what I'd like to see is a little bit more of what problems do people in the developing world face and how can a donor help with them? It's just so broad. It almost doesn't feel like a starting point.
Okay. We have a much more detailed version of what that means, so it's not like, you know, that question is not really a starting point. That's more trying to explain to people on the web what we're doing. I'm trying to think if we have something on the web that we could point you to, and if not, we could just kind of discuss right now what we mean by that. Ellie,
okay.
Any thoughts on that?
I'm not sure. What are you thinking of? That's more detailed. Do we have anything in those?
I'm thinking of the word. What?
Well, I'm trying to think of in the met. You know the metrics posts from the summer where we were talking about what metrics we were going to use. I wonder if those are anywhere in those. If we discuss more specifics of, you know,
those are those are pretty old. I mean, I think that the word, like, I think some combination of, like, the Word doc and just the list of interventions, which is a spreadsheet, I mean, would capture it. So, I don't know. Maybe I should just quickly just try and answer your question, you know, verbally, Alana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we're trying to do is, okay, what problems do people in the developing world face? I mean, that is a... is in some ways a very hard question to answer. In another way, you can do it a kind of rough cut pretty straightforwardly by using the global burden of disease and just saying, you know, what are the diseases? What are the symptoms? What are the burden of each? Okay, so that's diseases. And then from there, it's hard to really quantify a lot of the other problems with extreme poverty. We have a couple papers that try to do exactly that, so it's not really work that we have to do to reinvent the wheel. You know, Economic Lives of the Poor, which is this sort of big survey of people in extreme poverty looking at their living conditions, and I guess Voices of the Poor, which we haven't read yet, by the World Bank. So that's kind of the what are the problems, and then what can a donor do to help with them is more of these intervention reports. So we have, you know, if you looked at the Carter Center, we've got a report, for example, on mass drug administration to fight this disease or that disease. And the goal is just to do as many of those as we can and as are relevant to the sort of charities we're examining. So we want, you know, we want eventually, the ideal would be to have a report like that on basically every intervention that charities do. That's not realistic. But the thing that is more realistic would be to have a report like that on everything that comes kind of highly recommended from various sources, plus on anything that are sort of the strongest charities we've seen are putting a lot of resources into. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
And as far as highly recommended, we have a specific page that would support more what I mean by that, which is this, I don't actually remember the URL, but it's, I don't know if you read it or not, but it's linked in various places on the Carter Center report. And it's kind of this list of papers that we use to identify top interventions. And in fact, one of the questions we have is, are there more of these? Because I'm not going to lie, I'm not totally thrilled with the ones we have. I think there's more out there that could be getting us more stuff. So I can give you the URL if you want to pull it up of what I'm talking about.
I don't have internet at home because I'm in Tajikistan. So.
All right, well, I'll email it to you. You know, it's basically...
Okay, that'd be great.
I mean, just a real quick list. I mean, that, you know, we use J-PAL and IPA. Those are kind of the randomized controlled trial people. And I haven't yet looked at the World Bank group that's similar, but I'm going to. We looked at the Million Saved report by the Center for Global Development for kind of things that have worked on a large scale, even if a lot of those were government programs rather than philanthropy. We use the Disease Control Priorities report heavily. The Copenhagen Consensus, which is one of the few kind of large-scale efforts to identify top programs. And then, I mean, that's the basic idea of what we use to identify really promising stuff.
Okay.
So basically things that have worked on a large scale, things that have worked on a small scale, and things that are recommended by Copenhagen Consensus. And I wish we had more things like the Copenhagen Consensus, but I don't know of any.
Well, if we did, would we need GiveWell?
Yeah, it would all depend. I mean, depends what they're covering, what they're not. I mean, Copenhagen Consensus doesn't connect anything they're talking about to charities.
They're pretty broad, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, if there was someone connecting them to charities too and doing all the work, I don't know if we'd need GiveWell. But my point is, if there was more stuff like the Copenhagen Consensus out there, the Copenhagen Consensus has such a specific perspective, approach, you know, criteria, which is fine. I just, you know, I wouldn't mind finding more things like that. But we can't. So, hey, we take things that have worked before on a small scale, on a large scale, things that are recommended. That's basically what we're trying to do.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts before we, dive in to some specifics?
I think that was it.
Okay, so let me just give the brief Carter Center overview. You know, our goal is to find strong organizations that, you know, donors can have confidence in when they give their money that they're going to implement good programs. And so basically what we're looking for is charities that, you know, have proven programs, are monitoring their work, and are making that information available so it can be assessed by, you know, by donors and then GiveWell. And so, you know, we found the Carter Center, and they were in many ways, top notch on all those criteria. I mean, they run they largely do large-scale programs to combat neglected tropical diseases. You know, they're you know, really famous for leading the eradication campaign for guinea worm, but they also implement, you know, proven programs, cost-effective programs in onchocerciasis, lymphatic filariasis, deworming programs, and they monitor, you know, they monitor those programs very carefully, reporting both, you know, their outputs, like how many drugs they distribute in each place, and also comes often, you know, measuring the changes in prevalence of the disease in some subset of the areas they work, so they can see their impact. And they publish this all on their website. So, you know, we've had some limited contact with the Carter Center, but we didn't need to go any further than just going through the documents on their website to evaluate them. So those are really the strengths of the organization and why we support them. On the other hand, the reason that we are, and you know, our review is somewhat, or our recommendation is somewhat couched for them, because while some of the programs fit into that extremely, you know, rigorously proven, well-monitored approach, there are other programs they run that don't have the same criteria. So, for example, you know, somewhere in the middle of the provenness and monitored spectrum is their trachoma program, you know, where they run the SAFE strategy, and then the evidence of effectiveness, and what we've used to assess evidence of effectiveness has been Cochrane reviews, where we can find them, and where we can't, you know, trying to find other literature reviews of randomized controlled trials or other assessments by, you know, the same set of experts that we talked about before, and we, you know, lay that out on the website. So something like the SAFE strategy to combat or to control trachoma is not quite as proven as the programs I mentioned earlier. It's also their documents don't monitor it as well. They're still monitoring how many surgeries they perform and how many latrines they build, but they aren't consistently measuring changes in the prevalence of trachoma. And then similarly, there are other programs that are not even, not monitored or directly connected to a proven or even, you know, WHO-recommended area. And so those are their, you know, their mental health program and their an agricultural program. And with both of those, there's relatively limited monitoring. And the big issue with all of this is that we don't have a breakdown of their budget in terms of how much money they allocate each of these areas. So while we really like, a few of their programs, we're also concerned about others and not knowing how much money is going to which. When a donor gives to the Carter Center, what portion of their donation is supporting the great programs as opposed to the average programs as opposed to the questionable programs, we have some concerns about recommending that. And so I think that's basically our perspective on them. Holden, do you have anything to add?
I mean, well, I'd want to clarify why we spent so much time on them, why we highlighted them in the first place, because I think the review kind of comes out, well, some of this and some of that. I mean, the fact is, most big charities, you cannot figure out what they're doing, and you definitely cannot figure out if they're getting results. And I include both looking at their website and trying to work with them, even holding out the carrot of a $25,000 grant. Just from our experience, you're just not going to get anywhere. It's like they're doing a million things in a million places. You get some very vague info about them. You know, you have no sense that they're testing what they're doing, that they're, you know, making sure it's happening as intended. So we come across the Carter Center, and boom, right on their website is all this stuff that says exactly what they're doing, how it's going, how they're thinking about it, what they're learning, and they've been involved in one of the biggest global health success stories that people point to, which is the guinea worm thing. So those are, you know, immediate reasons that the Carter Center just jumps out above nearly all charities, and particularly large-scale charities in their kind of weight class. But, you know, as we push further in, then all the stuff Ellie's talking about is really what's big in my mind, which is, okay, the first impression, they've got a few programs that look really good and that are really clear, and then as you go further, it's almost like they're half and half, or maybe they're 80-20 or 20-80, I don't know. They've got a lot of stuff where it's totally unclear what they're doing, and they're not sharing any results from it, and you know, and I don't have much confidence in it. And then without the budget breakdown, we don't know what to do with that.
Okay, I mean, I see your perspective on that and how you came to that conclusion. It's a really interesting point that they're sort of halfway transparent. And I wonder, you know, does it come down to personalities within the organization or whatever? But that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I mean, it's such a hard thing to figure out. Should we be thinking of them as, you know, kind of one unified organization, and what really matters is management at the top, so if some stuff's good, it's probably all good. Or should we be thinking about them as, you know, so big that it's almost like many organizations bundled into one, in which case you really have no idea what happens when you donate to them. And personally, I think the second one is more likely to be accurate.
I mean, you probably have some idea what happens when you donate to them, but I can see what you're saying. And, I mean, does the Carter Center let you designate your donation?
Yeah, but here's an interesting issue. I mean, Ellie and I have been for a long time of the opinion that designating donations is not really effective or a good idea. You know, for one thing, kind of a philosophical thing, that what we really want to do is find a charity that we believe in from the top down, you know, the whole deal, and let them use the funds, because they've kind of demonstrated that they're thinking it through better than we would anyway. That's kind of the, you know, the ideal. And then just specifically, when you look at these charities' balance sheets, generally they have so much more unrestricted funds than restricted funds that I don't think that you're really influencing their priorities by restricting a donation. And this is something I don't know at all, but what I do feel fairly confident is that because of the nature of their balance sheet, they're capable of taking my $100 for lymphatic filariasis and just shifting $100 of unrestricted funds back into whatever it is they wanted to expand. So what it comes down to in the end is, what's their strategy? What do they want to expand? Not what do I want to expand? And I don't have a sense of what they want to expand, especially not without more detailed expense breakdowns.
I've actually got the opposite objection to designating your donation, to be honest, is that I genuinely believe in the importance of organizational development and in the importance of giving organizations the funds they need to grow and to support themselves and to be competent administrators and to do the kind of monitoring and evaluation we want to do to see impact. And I've worked for places that had, say, for example, really big Darfur programs because everybody kept designating their donation for Darfur. And we didn't have the kind of operating funds that let us just shift around and work with that. We were just stuck running enormous Sudan programs. And I remember we actually tried to see if we could change the donation button on the homepage to Sudan in the hopes that we could at least pull some of the funding for South Sudan.
Yeah.
So I think I think even fairly large organizations, I would disagree with you on that in terms of the ability of the donor to influence by choosing to designate. But on the other hand, I'm not really a big fan of that either for other reasons.
Okay, well, I do agree with your reasons too. I mean, that was what I was trying to say with the first point. So, you know, it's kind of both. It's we don't want to be pushing them around, and we don't really think we can push them around. So that's, you know, that's what it comes down to. So we want to find someone that we're confident in the whole organization, so we don't have to worry about pushing them around. But I am kind of interested in that. Like, do you think, like, the organization you're talking about, you didn't have as much freedom as you wanted. Like, I would be interested in what that organization's balance sheet looked like, because it's possible that the analysis I'm doing is just wrong. And then, in fact, I'm just misunderstanding something about it, and that we can, you know, that we can push Carter Center around. But what I would guess is that Carter Center is one of these enormous charities. They have a lot of funding, and we're not going to be able to push them around. And I don't know what the situation with yours was.
The one I'm talking about had an annual income, revenue, whatever, of about $100 million a year.
Wow, okay, that's
good. I'm sorry, I don't want to give you the name. But it was big. I was consulting for them, and it was big. And, I mean, I haven't looked at the Carter Center's annual budget, but also, you know, the organizational politics make it really hard to do those sorts of easy shifts, is that everybody's entrenched in their department and so on. Like, it isn't as fluid, not necessarily for good reasons. but it isn't as fluid as it could be that way. I mean, I can see how that makes sense, but it isn't what I've seen.
Right. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, if I thought we could push an organization around, would I want to do anything differently? Because I do still agree with you on the philosophical point, we'd rather not do that. But on the other hand, when we don't have a choice, I mean, would we do our process much differently if we were looking for just someone who had one good program that we could fund? Because it is hard to find an organization we could be fully confident in. I don't know.
Well, I'm kind of curious. I mean, would you say that, I mean, I don't know if this is something that you think you're in a position to be able to answer, but would you say it's like by and large the rule that, you know, when you earmark your, you restrict your donation to an area, you know, that the department that you've restricted it to is going to go out and say, okay, we've got these funds, we're going to, you know, they're ours now, we're less likely to share them back into the pool. Or is it really more, would you think of, you know, in your experience, like a case-by-case thing where some organizations may work one way where once if the money comes in earmarked, they just, you know, it adds to their group and they're not going to let it go, and others may be more fungible where it seems more likely to work the way that, you know, Holden was saying before.
Everywhere that I have worked, it has been my experience that restricted donations go where they're restricted to, and there doesn't seem to be any shifting organizational calculus. Although most of the places that I've worked, most of our funding has come in restricted, not unrestricted. And the other thing is the unrestricted funding often goes to support existing programs. Okay, for example, a lot of European donor agencies, the EU and ECHO, and a lot of UN agencies, when they support a big program, they don't support the total amount of administrative expenses.
Right.
So, for example, if your organization has a 17% overhead, the UN only pays you 10%. So you actually, when running that program, take a 7% shortfall because it costs you a genuine 17%. And almost always, the unrestricted donations go in to fill that gap. And once you've got your program running, you don't want to walk away from it. You don't want to leave those children in Nicaragua unvaccinated. You don't want to walk away from your IDP camp or your refugee organization or whatever. So you do everything you can to keep your programs running. So that's where the unrestricted donations are going, which means they're not fungible. Does that make sense? Am I being clear?
Yeah, that does make sense. I mean, it's certainly... It's a tough thing because if you restrict a donation, then you're not letting someone... You know, we believe in letting charities spend on overhead if that helps them. And you're kind of not letting them do that if you restrict. But if you don't restrict, then you really are supporting the whole organization at once. You know, especially, so let's say the funds are not going into one program or another, but they're mostly just supporting the overhead. Well, that means you're supporting everything. That means you should basically think about yourself as paying, you know, X percent for guinea worm and X percent for mental health, and you don't have a choice in the matter. So, you know, if there is a way we could say, okay, well, we want this money used for the, you know, the disease control program in Ethiopia, but we don't want, you know, we want it used for administration to the extent it would help with that, we would do that. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure we would do that, but it would be an interesting option. I'm not sure if there's a way to do that.
So, I don't know. There's also something that, Alana, you're saying that, you know, I wonder if it's representative of the Carter Center in particular and maybe other charities that we've looked at, which is that, you know, that the way you described the way the unrestricted funding is used sort of implies that there aren't a lot of reserves that the charity has access to, or that it, and when we look at the Carter Center, it's funny that we're talking a lot about financials because financials tend not to be where we focus. But, you know, one of the measures that we've considered is the ratio of, you know, unreserved cash assets to, you know, annual expenses. And when we see an organization with, let's say, 2 times as much in liquid assets, unrestricted liquid assets as annual expenses, it seems like that organization is in a position to, you know, essentially spend money where they choose to, as opposed to the, you know, examples you described where what it sounds like is they need to take in more money just to enable them to maintain their level of operation. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, and I do see the Carter Center as special just because it is the Carter Center.
Right.
And a broader comment is, I agree 100% with you with the idea that what you really want is one organization that you can support everything it does and not have to, you know, just be able to say, this is it, I'm putting my money in, I'm going to give it unrestricted, and I'm happy for it to go anywhere they think is appropriate, but I will be stunned if you can find some organization that meets that across the board.
Well,
with the kind of rigor you're looking for, because everybody's got a program that's experimental and unproven, but they really think it's going to work for some internal reason or something they've been doing for the last 10 years and nobody's had time to look at it and realize it doesn't work anymore.
Right. Well, I would say stuff in the first category I think is totally fine and what we would expect, and stuff in the second category is a huge sign of a problem, and it just all depends how the percentages break out. So, you know, my kind of ideal organization would be like at least 50% stuff that's worked before and is really proven. And, you know, and probably no more than, I mean, I wouldn't want to see any significant percentage on a program that's been running for 10 years and nobody's had time to shut it down. But hey, if there was 5% of their expenses going to that, I could live with that. And then, you know, an organization's experimenting too. So I don't think that we're not looking for 100% stuff that's already worked. But I think for a large organization, I think should be pouring the majority of funds into stuff that's already worked and could be experimenting for more stuff that's going to work, but shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be pouring all its funds into that.
If the goal is experimentation,
right,
then there should be some evaluation of whether the experiment has
Or it should be ongoing.
Is that the only way in which experiments?
It could be ongoing. Like, I don't expect to always see, there's no organization for which we've seen, you know, reports for every program, and yet we still do recommend organizations. But I think that if someone's experimenting, you know, they should have evaluations in progress, and then they've got some programs that are really well evaluated and some that aren't, but they're new, that all fits together and that's fine. What I don't want to see is something, you know, a giant organization that's pouring most of those hundreds of millions into new stuff, I think is probably not good for individual donors. And especially, you know, anyone who's putting a lot of money into stuff that just is bad. I mean, that I don't know why I think that seems like it's clearly a bad thing.
Well, just as a thought experiment, what about some organization big enough that it's getting U.S. government funding or something and it's running a program?
Hello? Okay, we lost her.
So I guess she'll call back in, right?
Yeah. She's not on the internet, so just wait for her.
Yeah.
La la la, la la.
Oh, she's not even on the internet. Wow. So you don't need, she won't even be able to.
Do we have a phone number for her?
She applied. I mean, we're going to cut. We'll cut this out of the video if we end up.
Hi, I'm back now. Sorry, the Tajik government call phone calls over. So sharing it.
Huh. That's interesting.
So you were just giving us a thought experiment.
Yeah, which is that you take the big charities of this world, the Save the Children, the World Vision, the Mercy, that sort of thing, and there are probably, I don't know the numbers for these exact charities, maybe 50% U.S. government funded, and that means they're taking money to run through probably kind of stupid, but it's government money. I mean, they're taking money from a donor to do something the donor wants to do in a pretty specific way. Like, does that count against them?
Well, I thought about, I mean, one, something I think about that is, you know, it seems like it should be spent on this program because it's bad. I mean, it depends exactly what, you know, I'm thinking of this program that is actually accomplishing nothing. You know, I mean, and maybe that's like a hypothetical, but in that hypothetical, like, it seems like it should count against them. Because I think of other examples, you know, there's the article, I remember reading a New York Times article about CARE. You know, about a year and a half ago, where they refused government money for food aid because they said, "This we think this is harmful," so we will not take money.
All right, Ellie, that's a bad program, like a harmful program. What about a program that's just not
for you? I wasn't arguing for harmful programs. I was arguing for sort of the not as good as it could be, the sort of goofy, the someone at USA drew up this RFA a little too late at night, and nobody else noticed, and then they ran it and funded it.
Yeah, and let's say a program, even maybe a program that's, you know, maybe perfectly fine in conception, but for whatever reason, the government's not giving them the money to evaluate it, and they're not evaluating it, and so we've got this mystery. I mean, how do we treat that? I mean, again, to me, it comes down to size.
There's plenty of programs, but there's just not enough funding if they're working.
I mean, to me, again, it comes down to the, you know, you got to have that relative breakdown. So, you know, to me, it comes down to size, which is, if you've got most of your funds are doing that, then the burden must be on you to show me that, oh, but the things we do when we have the freedom are great. And I think that has to be a case that's made. I mean, if it's not made, I don't think it's right to assume it by default. You know, at the same time, if someone is with a small amount of their funds is doing some goofy programs that we don't like, I don't really care. I mean, I care, but it's not the end of the world.
That's kind of interesting, because on the one hand, your methodology, I think, pushes you towards large organizations because they have the technical capacity and the staff to do the kind of rigorous monitoring and evaluation you're looking for. But on the other hand, the smaller ones are a lot less likely to take the stupid money because they don't have the capacity to think, oh, well, I can run that, or right, I need to keep my office and country open anyway.
Well, in a way, I think we are. I mean, sort of my preference would be to do the smaller, you know, the medium organizations, maybe along the lines of Partners in Health. That kind of Partners in Health has its thing that it does, and there are some variations for sure, but it's not running a billion programs. It's not having the government come up to it and say, hey, here's some idea that has nothing to do with anything else you do, why don't you do it? You know, they basically got their thing, and for that reason, you kind of have a good sense of what you're paying for when you donate to them. That's kind of my ideal, but it's true that a lot of those organizations, you know, they're not evaluating what they're doing, and when you're not evaluating what you're doing, then, you know, that's not worth very much. And so then we get to the big ones, and, you know, PSI, I think, is good. They have, again, PSI has their thing that they do. There's some variations, there's some random projects, but by and large, they're not running around doing a million undocumented things. They've got their organization-wide strategy, and that seems like a good thing. And then if we ran into someone else, you know, I agree with you. It gets very tricky if someone, let's say 60% of their money is doing random crap that the government wants them to do, and then they take individual donations and do wonderful things. I mean, how are we going to see that? It seems like there's no way to see that unless they're making that case on their website, in their application, whatever, because that isn't going to emerge from just scanning their activities. And so, you know, if it doesn't, bottom line, we're going to recommend the ones that we can be confident in and not the ones that we can't.
Well, I mean, this is only slightly, you know, somewhat related, but if it's one of the, if those government programs are the types that are also sucking in more money because the government is not paying for the full program, you know, like ultimately it's a question not of really how much of their budget goes to the program, but how much of the new money that comes in will go to the program. But yeah, I agree with Holden, something that would need to be made explicit, and it's almost never made explicit.
And also, though,
it's not the sort of thing anyone feels comfortable saying.
Well, I just want to add one point, and then we'll get to that. I mean, just to add on what Ellie was saying, I mean, these programs are eating up overhead, as you say, if they're not fully funding the overhead. But even if they are, they're still eating up human capital and, you know, managerial capital. So it's certainly, I think at the point where you're 50%, crap that the government wants you to do, I think that it's at the point where donors should be very worried, no matter what you're doing with the other 50%. But let's get to that point.
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty different. Holden, like, I feel pretty differently than you. Like, I think, I mean, I'm kind of curious why it's the right decision to take the money, because I would say that the charities should be, you know, should be paying to the government. We don't think this really makes sense, so we won't take the money. The same way, you know, I'd hope that, you know, we at GiveWell would take money to do things that we think are effective, but not take money just to, you know, increase the size of our
Ellie, it depends. You know, I think we have different. I think we have different things in mind. Like, I think you're thinking about that, like, food aid thing that actually hurts people, and I'm thinking about.
Well, I'm thinking about, I mean, abstinence education. You know, if
right. You're thinking about the very worst programs. I'm thinking about something like the government wants to give us money to train health workers. Well, we know a lot about health. we think we can train health workers. We wish we could monitor this and see if it's going well, but we still think we can do more good than harm if we train health workers, so why don't we? And that, to me, is not... I wouldn't.
Okay. Here's a real-life example, which was the Basra Children's Hospital in Iraq, which I think I emailed you as an example of basically a stupid project the government wants you to do. But if the government's going to be handing out money to do this anyway, might as well be the organization who does it better, who creates a better hospital, a hospital that's at least kind of useful, that lets you keep your Iraq country office open with the overhead, so if good money does come along, you can take it and actually help people. Like, I think part of it is, you know, Iraq, the money was sort of waning for a while, but, like, think of some country where it's really hard to keep your country program open, like, there are a couple countries in West Africa where it's really hard to get funding for, and you'll do anything to keep that country office open and keep your local staff on and keep your people in there so that they can respond if they're needed. Like, because once you close a country office, you've lost capacity in an entire place where you could have helped. So sometimes I think they take the stupid money just to keep those offices open so that they maintain that capacity.
That all makes sense.
And is that for, would you say that's mostly for, like, emergency relief or another reason?
No, I'd say it's really development both.
Okay.
Right. So that sounds...
Because, you know, you're never know when you're going to run into some rich old lady who really, really, really cares about Moldova, and you'd like to be able to respond, you know?
Right. It's like if you have some shortfall in your, you know, office and country X for 1 or 2 years, it makes sense, and you'd have to shut it down without any funds. It enables you to keep it open. I guess the issue would arise
exactly.
If the only reason you keep it, you know, if it just remains open over a really long period of time, just through these, I don't know what we're calling them, like less effective funds, then that's a bigger issue. But that makes sense. I understand
right.
that.
Right. I mean, to me, I still think, Ella, you should be thinking also about the simpler, I agree with all that. I also think, Ella, you should be thinking about the simpler example of just a program that probably does more harm than good, and is probably a good program, but you're not going to be able to rigorously evaluate it and publish the kind of stuff GiveWell wants to see. You would clearly.
That I'm totally on board with. I'm trying to think. It depends what type of program.
Like training health workers
is a
program.
You mean if it's like training health workers, that doesn't seem like a silly program to me. That
yeah.
seems like a program that might work, and maybe there's not evaluation. I'm thinking. So one example you gave was the Basra Children's Hospital. I don't know anything. I don't know. I didn't see the email on that, and so I don't know. Like what makes you call that this what we're calling like bad money?
Okay, well it's a children's cancer hospital, and children in Iraq are so incredibly lucky if they can live long enough to get cancer. I mean, it's just they should be vaccinating children in Iraq. They should be training outreach nurses. They should be rebuilding clinics. Working with the Ministry of Health would actually have the capacity to run the Iraqi health system. The last thing that they need is an expensive tertiary care hospital that makes a great target for suicide bombers.
Right.
I mean,
okay. I understand
So just, I mean, just stepping back, I mean, these are all fair points. I do want to emphasize that, you know, what we have to do at GiveWell is not get hung up on, you know, are we finding every good charity and are we leaving anyone out, but rather... You know, are we finding charities you can have confidence in, and what's the best way to do that? And so just, you know, just to be clear, I mean, okay, it's possible to miss a good charity because because there's no information out there about all the politics that cause their funds to be spent on bad programs. We just look, we see a bunch of bad programs. Well, that's too bad, but I think we have to focus on, you know, finding great charities, and the question is, you know, we know that the approach of looking for an organization that does where everything is good, we know that might not turn up enough positives, but at least is not very likely to have false positives. And so the question is, you know, I wouldn't want to abandon that strategy, but the question is there something we can add on to it that might get us more great organizations in a way that we can identify them? Because we need to be able to identify them. We need to be able to form confidence, and that is the bottom line, that we're not... You know, we're not taking on the impossible task of ranking every charity in the world. We're looking for charities that are not only good, but demonstrably good. And so on that topic, I think that, like, one thing I would take away from this conversation is I might put more weight on someone who has a couple really good programs, because it's possible that, you know, it's possible that a lot of the, I think I might put less weight on someone who has, I might be less concerned, or at least be more open to looking deeply into an organization that has a lot of good and a lot of bad, because it's possible that the good is much more relevant to what donors are doing. Especially if, you know, if you put it out there for donors, hey, you can restrict your donation. There are disadvantages to it, but there's also advantages to it, and it's your choice. So, for example, I mean, when I look at these University of Pennsylvania Center for High Impact Philanthropy reports, what they like to do is they like to identify an organization that's running one really great program and ignore everything else they're doing. And I think there might be some value in that, or something in between what they're doing and what we're doing, where you look at that organization and you say, hey, you know, you might want to try giving to these guys. There's certainly concerns. They run a lot of questionable stuff, too. You might want to restrict to this good program. That has disadvantages. You might want to give unrestricted. That has risks. Or you might just want to go with things that are done more on the GiveWell approach, the current GiveWell approach, where we've kind of checked out the whole deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think it makes sense that the high impact philanthropy is sort of taking an issue oriented approach. So if they're looking at malaria, they can't really be looking, you know, they're going deep into malaria rather than broad through an organization, which I think is sort of a complementary approach to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So one thing I'm kind of wondering, Alana, is you know, one perspective I have is that, you know, I'm skeptical of the, whatever we'll call the huge mega charities, you know, the CARES and the UNICEF and Save the Children, because of the issues that, you know, that we're raising, you know, not really knowing where the money's going, having some combination of our, let's say, highly effective proven programs and programs that we can't really find the evidence base for, a basic lack of monitoring of their program. And I'm curious if you think that skepticism is warranted, or you have a different perspective.
I think there's a lot of, I think a couple things. I think once you get big enough that you are taking government money, government donors have certain expectations with regard to monitoring evaluation and your ability to track where your funds go within an organization, that there's a level of professionalism and transparency and solid accounting that comes with being big enough to take money from the big donors. So I think that's an advantage to the big guys, is that, you know, you say that you feel like you don't know where your money goes and you donate to them, and that's true, but on the other hand, if you sit down with their accountants or whatever, they can tell you where every penny moves. And you talk to some of the smaller guys who are more just getting private donations, and they're not necessarily as rigorous in terms of their financial transparency and in terms of them being able to track where their money goes. And let's see. I think that the big ones are more likely to be mediocre, and I think that is both good and bad, because it means they're less likely to be terrible, but it also means they're less likely to be exceptional. I know that when people ask me questions like, you know, I want to donate in response to X major event, I always send them to the big donor unless I specifically know that there's a little one who's doing it really well,
right,
because they're reliable that they'll be at least mediocre, if that makes sense.
Right.
That's not what you're looking for, but that's sort of my feeling, is that there's just a certain level of professionalism that keeps you away from the really bad and destructive stuff. And I've seen a lot of small organizations just, you know, particularly founder syndrome, get wound up in one person's ego and be unable to readjust to what actually matters, to get stuck in one model that they believe makes sense and never be able to come out of it.
Right.
You know, giving bicycles to rural women who will never, ever ride a bicycle because they think it's going to take away their virginity, and there's no point trying to do an education program to get people to ride more bicycles, because at that point it's stupid, and you're sort of negating the impact of the bicycles with the sheer volume of training you have to do. Or, you know, projects where they want people to raise broiler chickens, but they procure the wrong kinds of chickens. or, you know, they don't write their contract for the sheep well enough, and they end up with sterile sheep. This actually happened to a project because they didn't put it in, the sheep had to be able to reproduce.
Wow. I don't suppose there's a public documentation of any of
these.
I don't suppose there's public documentation of any of these stories you're telling, because they're pretty interesting. Is there?
I don't think so, because it's not something that anyone puts in reports. And when it's a private donor's money, they don't necessarily come back and ask.
Right, but you are okay.
I mean, if you made that kind of mistake with funding from USAID, you have to tell them. But if you make that kind of mistake with $10, someone sent you an envelope, no one ever has to know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so that's all fair. I mean, I still wonder, like, is there a way?
I think that Debt Partners in Health is kind of your ideal. Somebody who's deliberately small.
Right.
Someone who's chosen the thing that they believe in and they're going to do it forever. I like the Hesperian Foundation. It's all about educational publishing for the developing world on appropriate technology and health.
The what foundation?
Like, the places that stay deliberately small.
What foundation?
Yeah,
what was the last thing?
Being small because you're new. Hesperian. I can Hesperian.
Okay.
They publish where there is no doctor.
Okay.
So I guess it's the people who are small by choice, not small because they can't get the funding or because they're new.
Right.
I think those are the essential organizations.
This is totally random. I mean, do you know of any way to see organizations turning away money? You know, because that, I can imagine, is sort of a heuristic we could use to identify good organizations, if there was some way to check that somewhere. But it's probably not the type of thing that would be measured.
I mean, I wouldn't guess that you often have people asking you to take money and you say no. I think by turning away money, Alana's probably more talking about not applying for things that you probably would be able to win. Maybe wrong with
right.
that.
Yeah. The Academy for Educational Development refused to apply for the Iraq Education Reconstruction Program because they believed it was badly designed and wasn't going to work. But, I mean, they issued a press release after they refused to apply. So it wasn't like that's been, you know, recorded somewhere. I know it because it was their publicity.
So, Alana, what do you think about these global health partnerships? Because I have to say, a lot of them are pretty appealing to me. I look at something like, I'll just give an example, the Global Alliance to Eliminate Lymphatic Filariasis. You know, in a way, it's huge, but it's very focused. It's very clear what they're doing. It has a top-down strategy. And so they're working with a lot of partners who may not have top-down strategies, but I feel like if I give my money to that alliance for eliminating lymphatic filariasis, they're going to use it for something that I think is good, and I don't have to worry about all these politics of which project the money's getting spent on, because it's all for lymphatic filariasis. I mean, what do you think about that kind of thing?
I think that makes sense if it's well run, and I think you have to do the same
right.
sort of backgrounding you always do to make sure that it's a well-run partnership. But I totally agree that it's a nice approach in terms of being restricted to an issue you care about and see as something that can be impacted well, and yet leaving the freedom in to decide which particular approach needs to be happening, like not having to pick a program.
Right. I mean, tell me if I'm off base, but I think we are kind of agreeing on a general approach, which is rather than, you know, I think your comment about the small by choice organizations is interesting and could be useful to us in a heuristic way. Just talking about, you know, what is the criterion for a good organization? It's someone who kind of most of what they do or everything they do looks good and well monitored, and that's the real test. And so that could, you know, that could come about in many ways. It could come about because they're a huge organization with a clear focus. It could come about because they're small by choice. But either way, I mean, the excellent organizations are likely to fit that criterion, and the ones that don't aren't likely to be excellent. Is that something that you would agree with?
Yeah.
Although, I mean, that said, I think that, you know, the idea of paying a little more attention to the organizations that do a lot of good and a lot of bad, I think is something we should be keeping in mind, because I have changed my mind about a couple things as a result of this conversation. You know, mostly, what is it? How fungible are the funds, and what does it mean when someone's doing a lot of bad stuff? So, or at least not well-monitored stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think that's going to be an important distinction to keep in mind, the difference between hard to document and actually bad.
Right. It is a very hard distinction, because usually when something is bad, that pretty much guarantees it won't be documented. So it's not like you can chart you know, good impact, bad impact, and unknown impact. It's always just good and unknown. But, you know, I might draw the line at something like, okay, this is a program that has worked somewhere, and they're just not evaluating it, versus this is a program that has no track record in general, and they're not evaluating it.
Yeah, that's a nice way to look at it, that at least if it's an intervention that's been proven somewhere else,
yeah,
at least, you know, it can work.
Yeah, and that is very baked into our approach these days because of the way we do these intervention reports. You know, we look for good programs, we look for charities running them. That's one of the things we do.
So on that point, you know, we said before some of the sources we've used for identifying our top programs, but are there any other places that you think we should look? You know, when we take this approach of you know, this program has been, here's a charity running program, you know, training public health workers. We want to know if that, you know, worked somewhere else. Is that, you know, and so we've looked at the disease control priorities report. We've also looked at, you know, these other more, you know, like summaries of randomized controlled trials, which I doubt would have anything for that. Are there any other sources that you'd recommend we look at?
That's a good question. I mean, it sounded to me like you'd named pretty much everything major and useful in terms of trying to find that kind of data. I mean, there's, you know, USAID keeps reports on everything they ever fund. They have a website, the Development Experience Clearinghouse, and you can check there for project reports on different things. But again, a project report to a donor is pretty much geared towards reporting successes, and you have to read it pretty carefully to figure out what they're not talking about. And it's not, you know, that's not necessarily a rigorous scientific evaluation. That's just a project report, but that's a place you can find out if an intervention has been tried. Trying to think what else there is. I think you really hit on most of it.
Because then it seems like when I think about, you know, the approach of saying, here's a charity running a program, has it worked somewhere else? That list is still going to be pretty short, you know, in terms of the programs that have worked somewhere else. And it's largely going to be, I guess, direct, you know, on the pretty close to direct medical interventions, you know, are the one, either the measurable or the ones that tend to have, you know, the strong evidence behind them. And I'm not even sure, you know, it seems like the vast majority would still, you know, end up in that unknown bucket. And so I'd still have the same basic perspective on those big organizations because, we'd have to check the budget, but, you know, I'd still be guessing that it's in the, you know, 80% ballpark for programs that don't haven't been shown to work somewhere else.
Right.
It depends. I mean, I think a lot of these health programs have decent track records. So, I mean, I could see an organization that, let's say, it has one or two things that are really good, like the kind of things that you, Penn, highlighted, and then it has, you know, a lot of other stuff it's doing is kind of these health programs, and we can't really tell what's going on, but a lot of the health programs, depends, I mean, a lot of them haven't, but a lot of the health programs have pretty decent track records. On the other hand, someone who a ton of what they're doing is the more more generic community mobilization and economic empowerment, I mean, the fact is those kind of programs are just not, they don't have the same kind of track record, so. And I think most,
right.
And most
I think
organizations are more in the second category.
What did you say?
I think,
one
well,
thought
go ahead.
This came to mind with the, there's a lot of literature on child survival, a lot. And child survival includes a whole bunch of interventions. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, the U.S. government child survival funds are very rigorously evaluated, so that might be something to look at to find out what's been done health-wise. But you're right about, you know, community mobilization, empowerment. Those are a lot harder to find. They're a lot harder to measure, and they're a lot harder to find rigorous examples of what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, and generally I would say that it's not, you know, it's always hard to make this distinction because, again, failures aren't shared, but I would say that measurement is part of success, and especially when you're dealing with challenges like this one, you know, working with people you ultimately, I don't think, know much about. So I think, you know, I think programs like community empowerment and economic empowerment, I think it's fair to say that they, you know, they don't have encouraging track records. It's not just that they're hard to measure. And the two could be intimately related, that anything that is hard to measure is hard to really get right. So I'm actually...
I never really thought about it that way, but I see your point.
So I have kind of a, I have kind of an unconnected question. Is it okay if I ask that, that you might have some thoughts on? The one of the things that we really struggle with is understanding where the bottleneck is to scaling up something good, and especially when is the bottleneck money versus when is the bottleneck something else. And so this is something that, like, I get a very vague sense of just from reading the way people talk about it. For example, I think, you know, I think with bed nets, I think there actually do need to be more literal, like, bed nets bought and distributed, that those things need to be paid for more, and that money is a bottleneck there. There's other things where I'm less sure that money is a bottleneck, and but I don't really know how to get to the bottom of this, how to figure this out. You know, what's kind of, I think vaccines are an area where it's more, it seems to me that there's, you know, well certainly ORS, it seems like, has been brought to a lot of the world, and where we're at now is trying to bring it to, like, much harder to reach areas where the cost effectiveness might not be as high. So it's kind of these vague impressions I get of trying to figure out, okay, we've got an intervention that looks pretty good, it's worked before, but is it now at the point where there's enough money paying for this, and now we need to focus on that? That's a question I've had a lot of trouble with. And certainly, one thing I found interesting about the UPenn study is that they have very clear opinions on that question. The opinions, they don't give evidence for them, but they're clear and plausible-sounding opinions. I don't know how to form them, and we're planning to ask them. I mean, we are setting up a call with them. But I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that challenge, because it's one of the things we really don't know how to do very well.
Yeah, it's such a broad question that I think it's something you just have to look at case by case. I mean, my gut instinct on ORS is the same as yours, that to a large degree we've pushed it through just about it where everybody knows about it. It's been approved by governments. In terms of vaccines, yeah, I always think that the vaccines, the two bottlenecks on vaccines are the cold chain and people's fear of the vaccine. But, you know, that's not evidence-based. That's just always been my theory.
I mean, a lot of people talk about adding new vaccines to the traditional expanded program in immunization. So, again, it's almost just like the only way that I know what needs funding is just what people talk about needing funding. So I guess the difference is between, you know, there's interventions that I see people like Disease Control Priorities Report and Copenhagen Consensus and J-PAL saying we should do more of this. And so they say, you know, we should do more of buying bed nets. We should do more of adding vaccines. Uh-oh, we lost her again.
It's been another half hour.
I know. What else should we cover in this call? Are we pretty much done?
No, if we have any other major questions.
Well, do we? I mean, we should just outline our plan for me.
I mean, how we can, I mean, maybe one question is, because she's worked with a lot of charities, is, you know, how do we get that? How best can we get the information we're talking about wanting?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
is that,
good idea.
Budget, like, what is the name of the person? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not, or the title or something.
Yeah.
How do we get in there?
Yeah.
Or is there someone at USAID that could, you know, just give us the USAID breakdown? Because, you know, we've failed to do that, you know, through online in a couple of contexts, but you might know that too.
Yeah.
Right? Like, because we could go to all the governments, maybe.
Yeah.
And have them give us, you know, we talked about that. Those are the two questions I have for sure. To think of anything else. Or it might turn out that the government of Tajikistan puts a hard 1 hour limit on phone calls.
Half.
And then you can't call for a day. Oh.
Half hour.
Hello?
Hello?
I guess that was just you.
Yeah, I was leaning back.
So do you have anything else we need to talk about? Because after this call, I'm breaking. But I could also call you if we had to discuss something.
No, I need to do a bunch of stuff. I'm behind.
You don't have any recollection of how long the downtime was last time, do you?
I don't think it was this long, but could be wrong.
Well, I guess we're going to wait a few more minutes. It does kind of throw the charity scan thing for a loop. I mean, it's still good to do. I guess it makes me want to speed up more, though. You know, just try to check whether they have good monitoring reports. Like, I just feel like I'm back to that almost. Like, the check is like, one, do they do 100 things? If they do 100 things, almost always, it's like the totally average breakdown is always, you know, a few things that you recognize as good from the priority list. And then a whole bunch of things that you have no idea about, right? Which include just vague descriptions of community things, vague descriptions of health-related things, nutrition-related things, and, like, at best, one or two reports of output. But it's for, like, one of 100. You know, it's like the sample,
yeah.
Not even, you know, not representative, not comprehensive. It's like a sample. And that's the best-case scenario. And it seems like all the other stuff doesn't even, like, you just want to know, are they a mega, you know, is this, like, basically on the lines of that type of mega charity? Is that their profile, and do they blow you away with some other type of monitoring? And all the other distinctions don't really matter that much. And I think we tried that at one point. Remember I did that sample, like, a couple months ago? And that was, like, 2 minutes per organization. Because, like, I am taking a little, like, what is slowing me down, you know, I did maybe 4 this morning, and what makes them take 5 to 10 minutes is, like, the thinking about whether, you know, they are running, well, whether, you know, they have a few programs on the priority list or zero or, you know, half, when really you can't figure that out. And once they do a lot, you know, they're going to have some. Because everyone's going to mention.
Yeah, I think zero versus some. I think it should be like 90% or not. Would be.
Well, you never know. I mean, the thing to be clear is you never
right.
Like. It's not like there's a list of projects.
Right. I know.
You know, and you can like do.
But if it looks like
so
if it looks
like
they pretty much only do good stuff, like they're which would generally you know generally is going to mean they're a health only organization. Usually is what that means. And it usually means something a little more too, because a lot of the health, you know, more key. So if it looks like they, you know, they're pretty much devoted entirely to good stuff, then that's one thing. You know, it's a couple minor exceptions. And if it doesn't look like that, then you can lump all those other ones together.
Right. And then we're so then it's that, and you know, in addition to the, do they you know, looking through it, are they showing that they're somehow doing some, you know, 2Z monitoring of their activities, which would show that they're pretty fundamentally different, and we'd want to know about that.
Yes.
See, that just seems like we can do that real fast, so I'm going to try that.
Okay.
I mean, one other thing that does make it go slower is just trying to be careful not, you know, not to miss something. You know, because there's 6 different places that they could hide it. And then you find the publication, you want to, like, open them to see what they are. And they have 5 different types of publications.
I think we should do that. I think that's worth doing. I think a lot of times it's, like, the last place you expect is where they have the great monitor. Because,
yeah,
and
I
the reason,
and so then do you,
they don't think anyone wants to see it. That's why it's often hard to find.
Right, and so would that mean, I mean, I think, so it's also possible that what I'm, that I'm wrong about what's taking me the time, and so I just have to, I think I'm just going to keep scaling down the charity scan and seeing if it speeds up, you know, in terms of not, you know, only checking the thing we just talked about checking,
yep.
because it's so totally plausible that it's the clicking everywhere that takes the time, because you have to check the program,
yep.
you know, the publications, the resources, open the annual report, you know, check the sitemap. I mean, that's basically what I'm doing, clicking all the programs, clicking anything that looks like resources or information or publication, and then opening them, and then opening the annual report, and then doing the sitemap. Those four things always.
Yeah.
I think the other thing I could do is like Google search the site for technical, which is not a bad idea. You know, trying to find
yeah.
the keywords that will turn it up when they put in it somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty effective.
That's a good idea.
If we can find the right
one. I like that. You know why else is because we could take a list of URLs and like and throw together some omnibus search and like publish the results of that, which would be you know, it wouldn't be the only thing we do, but that could be 80%.
Yeah, so we just need to find the right words. I mean, technical is often going to turn up and not be valuable, and I don't just mean because they're going to use the word technical. But like, what do you think of this? So I looked at this charity this morning, you know, that has tons of technical reports, and what the technical reports are like surveys of nutrition in a region before they go in. So that's good. You know, that makes me happy that they have them.
Yeah.
But it's just not what we need, which is the post, you know, after they do the activity, what the nutrition is.
I wonder if that Google search could be the whole thing. And the only reason I say that is because that's how literature reviews are done, and it's like an accepted thing.
Right. They have the tags that everyone uses. Like, you know
what
to search for. If we could figure out the right things to search for, then I agree that it would be the whole thing.
Well, yeah, but academia does not have official tags. Academia, they're doing the same thing we are. They're just, you know, we know they're pretty good at it. So if we think we're pretty good.
Well, and you search for malaria in the abstract, and you're going to pull up all the BedNet papers.
Yeah.
That's pretty clear.
That's true.
But we don't know the right way to do it. So I do think the Google search is important because, you know, think about how we organize our site. Like, it's so easy to just totally miss something when clicking through. What would it take for us to have a sitemap?
It's probably really easy.
Because it's incredibly useful to have a sitemap. You know, going to a website and just being able to click that and seeing some layout.
Yeah.
All right, well, I guess we should call this.
Yeah.
Since she's not here. I'm going to be away from my phone now for a while, but...
We don't have a number for her?
We might, but she applied for the job, remember, and so I bet that there's a number on her resume.
Let's try and call it. I'd much rather call her and tell her what's going on than just go away, but if we have to go away, we'll go away. Are you looking for it?
No, I'm not at my computer.
Oh, okay.
You know, one thing to consider is I think this call went a lot better because it was only the two of us and her and not, you know, if it had been like five people, it would have been, I guess it just would have been different. It would have been fine. And she ended up being helpful, so.
It is another, like, it just keeps hitting me again and again, though, that, like, if you want people to be useful to you, you have to have specific questions. Like, you cannot...
You're saying that when we just ask for feedback, we don't get very
Yeah, much. Like, remember how the call started? She had, like, almost nothing to say, but then she does have all this useful stuff to say. And it's the same thing with experts, like, just... I mean, it's fine. It's what we've always thought. It's what we've always done. I keep thinking about all the evidence in my head for when someone says, why are you guys doing this? Why don't you just ask people who know what they're talking about? That's why. Because if you just ask people, what do? They have no clue. But if you ask them specific questions, you get lots of interesting information.
Right, but the only reason that it's, you know, the obvious downside to what you're saying is that you then have them answering within your framework, and sometimes you need them to tell you that, you know, the whole pattern.
But a lot of times that happens. But a lot of times that happens within the framework. Like it's, you know, you say very specifically, this is what we're doing. What do you think? And you'll oftentimes get the big picture feedback. Like for me, Alana giving feedback on the whole notion, which I think we ended up agreeing on, but the whole notion of, you know, trying to find a charity you can be fully confident in. But the thing that never happens is when you just go, what should we do? And someone has an idea. Because they're not, it's not their job. It's not what they think about.
Right.
So I finished White Man's Burden this morning, so that's good. So I'm ready to talk to Bill Easterly. Whatever happens. I also finished End of Poverty. I'm looking for Alana's number right now. Oh, here's her resume.
It may not be the right number anymore.
I know.
You know, like if she...
I know, it's worth a shot. Wow, it says it has 2 minutes left to download 70 kilobytes. That's good.
You search for her on Skype. Try that.
Well, she's not going to be online. She has no internet.
Oh, yeah.
The whole issue. That's why we can't just email her.
I mean, I'm talking about a telephone. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Idiot.
All right, here we go.
Are you calling her?
Pull it up her resume. Oh, here's a number. Let's see if this works. If it doesn't, probably.